It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, cooking can be a stressful chore, but it doesn't always have to be. We'll talk to the author of the new cookbook, Good Enough, about making peace with imperfection in the kitchen and the link between cooking and our mental well-being. First, one of the hallmarks of most sports broadcasts is the statistical trivia. Like, this is only the first time in so many years a player has done this impressive, yet maybe random thing. Here's an example. We hear Bob Uecker on the call.
Here it is. Yelich knocks one to the gap in right center. This could be the one. Ah, he's going to be held to a double. He's trying for three. He's going to do it. Get down. He's in there. Christian Yelich. Ask and you shall receive.
And what was the random impressive stat?
You've done something that no player has done before, and that's hit for the cycle twice against the same team in one season. You're the first to do it. How do you describe what tonight was like?
I don't know. I have no idea how to describe that or what that feels like, but it was pretty awesome, and, you know, you guys are awesome.
That pretty awesome performance was from September of 2018 with the Brewers playing the Cincinnati Reds. Our next guest put together some of the most impressive sports achievements of all time with some numbers to back them up. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of your most memorable sports moments you've ever seen on TV, in person, or heard on the radio? What did it feel like to experience it live as it happened? Is there a performance in a single game, a single season, or in a career that really stands out in your mind in the sports world? If you're an athlete or former athlete, if you've done something amazing in your sport at whatever level, what did it feel like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Derek Thompson has been thinking a lot lately about amazing standout sports performances. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, host of the podcast Plain English, author of the book Hitmakers. His new piece in The Atlantic is out today. It's called What's the Most Amazing Statistical Achievement in U.S. Sports History? Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
What got you thinking about this specific question, Derek?
That's a great question. What got me thinking about it? I've always been a stat head. To be honest with you, when I was a kid, I liked playing baseball, but I loved memorizing baseball stats. And because I was always, like, you know, the eighth best hitter on my team, but always had the deepest reservoir of, like, random RBI knowledge, sometimes I would just, like, hang out in the dugout and the coaches would ask me questions like, hey, who is the all-time leader in RBIs? And I'd be like, I think it's Hank Aaron. You know, who's the all-time leader in hits? I think it's Ty Cobb or P. Rose. And I just loved that. I guess I basically, you know, have carried that with me into my journalistic career. And on one lazy Saturday afternoon, I just fired up Twitter and I asked Twitter, what do you think is the most statistically unusual sports accomplishment in American sports history? I guess it was inspired by an article that I'd read about Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game. Obviously, that's legendary. No one's beaten it. But I did a little bit more reading, and it turned out that Chamberlain had more impressive statistics in terms of how they compared to other basketball players. Like, he scored 60 points on 32 separate occasions. The next most on that list is Kobe Bryant with five. So he did 500. Will Chamberlain had accomplished that 500% more than any other player. I thought, wow, maybe there's an interesting way to compare stats across sports. You know, any stat that's like 50% greater than the next greatest stat in that category. And I basically gathered all these responses from people on Twitter and then organized them in this article for The Atlantic.
And that's the key. You wanted to try to quantify it, and you admit in your piece, this is kind of an arbitrary way to do it, but it's an interesting one. Talk about that 50% better than anyone else as the milestone, the cutoff for an amazing statistical achievement.
Yeah, everybody has their own subjective definition of amazing. For some people, it's Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hit streak. For some people, it's Cal Ripken's consecutive games played streak. I wanted, though, to have one benchmark that I could use across sports. So the best that I came up with is what I called the 50% club. That is, what sports records are at least 50% greater than the relevant second-place accomplishment. So let's apply the 50% club to Cal Ripken's 2,632 consecutive games played. That's an amazing record. It's a record we should cherish, but it doesn't beat second place by 50%. Lou Gehrig very famously played also in more than 2,000 consecutive games. So it doesn't enter the Hall of Fame, the 50% club that I made up, but it's still very impressive. For a record that does make it into the 50% club, let's think about a Green Bay Packers record.
Let's.
Great. Don Hutson's 1942 season, all right? Green Bay Packers wide receiver Don Hutson in 1942 won the Triple Crown in receiving. But he didn't just have the most receptions, yards, and touchdowns. He had more than twice as many receptions, more than twice as many yards, and more than twice as many touchdowns as the next leading receiver in each category. I am not aware of anyone ever in any sport who's won his respective Triple Crown by doubling the totals of the first and second place. So, Cal Ripken, you're an icon, you're legendary, but I'm sorry, Don Hutson makes it into my 50% club, and you do not.
Talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic about his new piece, What's the Most Amazing Statistical Achievement in U.S. Sports History? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Not going to make you do the math behind yours. What is a standout athletic performance anywhere in the history of sports? What do you think is the biggest achievement, or what's one that you were really impressed by? Whether in a single game, a single season, or a whole career, join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Packers may be on your mind this weekend. Is there a moment you'd point back toward in their history, or a stat, or a player, or a career? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Derek, let's go to NFL quarterbacks now. Now, Packer fans could name probably three that they'd put on their greatest of all times list, but for your statistical benchmark here, we got to look out east to Tom Brady. Why is that?
Well, look, Tom Brady's entire postseason record is just one 50% club ticket after another. I mean, he's played football for so long, and he's made the playoffs so often, that basically all of his statistics in the postseason are FPC, 50% club worthy. The best statistic that I found, this is from Boston sports radio host Alex Barth. This is just ridiculous. I'm quoting from Alex here. So, quote, the NFL record for career completions is 67.8%. Tom Brady has made the conference championship 73.7% of the seasons he's been the primary starter. So Tom Brady makes the conference championship at a rate higher than any quarterback completes passes, end quote. Like, what? That doesn't make any sense. It's crazy. So, of course, Brady has the most playoff games. He has the most playoff wins. He has the most playoff touchdowns. The greatest playoff comeback in history. He has number one, 25 points against the Falcons. I think he also has number two, 10 points against the Seahawks. Basically every single postseason statistic for quarterbacks. Look, Aaron Rodgers is extraordinary. Brett Favre is extraordinary. Bart Scott, like you guys have an extraordinary history of quarterbacks in Green Bay. But Tom Brady's postseason record is the Mount Kilimanjaro that soars above the plains of everybody else's postseason history.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Looking for your favorite moments, favorite achievements in the sports world. Susie is with us in Williams Bay. Susie, hi.
Hi there. I think for an individual thing, I would say Kirk Gibson's home run when he had the bad leg. Mm. And I think as far as like a dominating performance, I would say Eric Heiden in the Olympics with speed skating, or Mark Spitz swimming in the Olympics.
Ooh.
And also Secretariat winning the Triple Crown.
Great ideas there, Susie. I was there once for a Kirk Gibson home run when he played for the Tigers. It was a unique game that might be in the 50% club. Three bench-clearing brawls. They almost had to call the game because they were out of players. Both sides had nine, and Kirk Gibson ended up winning it with a home run. Very memorable. I don't know if you looked at those in particular, Derek, but you did look at one Olympic one, Simone Biles.
Right. Yeah, I looked at Simone Biles. Simone Biles is punched her ticket into the 50% club, her 19 world championship gold medals. is almost twice as many as any other female gymnast. She also, by the way, has the most total world medals of any gymnast, male or female. She is in the club. There's another Olympic record that I am totally fascinated by and made it into sort of the waiting room outside of the club. Bob Beamon's record-breaking long jump at the 1968 Summer Olympics in Mexico City. I did not know this story, but I'll tell it briefly because I really went down an internet rabbit hole understanding what happened in Mexico City in 1968. So in the 1960s, new long jump records were typically set by anywhere between half an inch and an inch, 2 inches. Bob Beamon in 1968 broke the all-time record by 22 inches. He broke the all-time record by 10 times more than people typically break records. The jump was so long that it famously forced the officials to stop the Olympics briefly so that they could find new measuring equipment to bring out to the sand and measure what had just happened. When Bob Beamon learned that he'd broken the record by almost 2 feet, he was so emotional that he collapsed and experienced what doctors later called a cataplectic seizure. So Beamon can't make it into the FPC officially because his record set in 1968 was eventually broken at another world championship. But it does, in fact, remain today the longest standing Summer Olympic record of modern times. So Bob Beamon's record-breaking long jump, not technically in the 50% club, but absolutely should be a sports movie.
And he did recover from that seizure, right?
And he did, I should say.
Don't want to leave people hanging there.
Sorry, thank you.
That's Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic. He has a new piece called What's the Most Amazing Statistical Achievement in U.S. Sports History? He has a ruler to use to see what really stands out. You could share yours, math or no, at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the achievements we've talked about so far? What stands out to you in your sports watching or sports participating history as a great standout achievement from an individual athlete, a whole team? One moment, one game, one season, one career? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the most amazing and memorable U.S. sports achievements in history with Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic. You can join in with your nominations at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Hi, Yordis.
Hi. I think that Tom Brady's records should be looked at more carefully because he cheated. He had the scandal where people were deflating the footballs, which makes it easier to throw and easier to catch. And we really don't know how long that was going on and whether that affected his statistics. And also, when he was with New England, they were using video equipment to steal signals during many of those Super Bowl runs. We don't know, I mean, at least I don't, how long that was going on before it was discovered. So I guess I think there should be an asterisk next to Tom Brady that people call him the greatest of all time, but I'd say he's the greatest cheater of all time.
Yordis, thanks for the call. Strong words, Derek. Do you want to put an asterisk by Tom Brady's name?
I'm going to decline to put an asterisk by Tom Brady's name. I have thoughts about Deflategate that are definitely too long to air in the middle of a segment that is about the entire history of American sports accomplishments. I will simply, because my job here is to represent statistics, represent a statistic. The Deflategate was, well, first off, let me say this. I'm a Peyton Manning fan, okay? I'm not a Tom Brady fan. I'm a Peyton Manning fan, and it gives me no pleasure to rattle off any positive statistics about Tom Brady. I liked his rival. That said, the Deflategate game was January 18th, 2015. Tom Brady won three more Super Bowls after 2015. He won in 2017, he won in 2019, and he won in 2021 as a 43-year-old. So even if you did want to throw out all of the Super Bowl wins from Tom Brady before 2015, you're still left with someone who has more Super Bowl wins, or excuse me, as many Super Bowl wins, I believe, as almost any quarterback other than, what, Joe Montana, who maybe has four? So Brady's career is an extraordinarily long, extraordinarily successful career. And what he's doing into his 40s has no equivalent in sports history from a Super Bowl winning standpoint.
Thanks for the call, Yordis. Before I go back to our callers, one that I think a lot of people would put an asterisk on major list, and you talk about this, Barry Bonds' early 2000 stats, including his intentional walk numbers.
Yeah, this is another one where, if the caller wanted to complain about my inclusion of Barry Bonds and his steroid use, admitted steroid use, I would grant that. Look, I don't know what to do with Barry Bonds' stats in terms of, say, letting him into the Hall of Fame. I don't know what to do with his stats as a benchmark of morality. But all I can do is analyze statistics, and these statistics don't make any sense. Barry Bonds' 2001-2004 seasons are one of the most extraordinary runs by any player in any sport. And my favorite statistic about Barry Bonds' early 2000s is his intentional walk record. Barry Bonds broke the record for most intentional walks in baseball history was 45 set by Willie McCovey in 1969. Bonds broke that in 2002 with 68. Then he broke it again in 2004 with 120. So he tripled, essentially, the intentional walk record. He has so many intentional walk records because, essentially, by the time he was putting up these numbers in 2004, pitchers didn't even want to face him when they were losing. They didn't want to face him when the bases were loaded. So he was walked in all sorts of extraordinary circumstances that create a bunch of different hilariously complex records, which I talk about in the article and won't go into detail here. But basically, people know Barry Bonds for the hitting. They know him for the on-base percentage. But the record that really shatters everything else is the intentional walk record.
Let's go back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Madison. Bob, hi.
Thank you. This is a college athlete, quarterback at Marshall University, my alma mater, Byron Leftwich, who injured his leg, could not walk, yet they kept him in the games all season, and his role was to pass, complete a pass, get picked up by two linemen, carried down the field to the next scrimmage line, pass, be picked up by two linemen, get carried down the field, and he did that and won game after game after game, being unable to walk at all, except he did make one run. He made a first down by hopping for a yard and a half on one leg. That is the year that he was also nominated for the Heisman Trophy, and I think right now he's being considered for a coaching position at the Chicago Bears.
Bob, thanks. Well, that's suffering there if he takes that. Bob, thanks for the call, though, from your alma mater. That's something that's harder, Derek, to get that gutsy performance. The stats might not show it, but the story sure can.
Yeah, maybe the right statistic is largest ever comeback with a broken shin, because Byron Leftwich broke his left tibia, came back into the game, and then rallied his team down 17 against Akron. This was in November 2002. Ironically, Byron Leftwich is now the coach of Tom Brady. So I guess it all comes back. It all comes back to Brady. Also, rather remarkably, Byron Leftwich is younger than Tom Brady, even though he's coaching him. So yeah, a lot of fun records, I suppose, on the Tampa Bay Bucks. But you probably want me to move off of fun Tampa Bay Buck records in the next few seconds. So we can go back to the callers or
sure.
Back to the article.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Dave joins us now in La Crosse. Dave, hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What's your nomination or nominations, Dave?
Well, my nomination is a little bit different, but I'll explain it a little bit. You know, so many of the incidents and players that you're talking about didn't necessarily rejoice all the people that were watching those teams, but this particular team did. It was the Miracle on Ice, the ice hockey for the Olympics that reunited this nation, excited people. They were all watching and made a huge difference nationwide in exactly what sports should be. It was a team that was statistically eliminated from beating that Russian team, but overcame all obstacles and won a hockey game that reunited a nation.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Derek, again, this one might not show up in your statistical memory, but it definitely stands strong in Dave's memory.
Yeah, it's interesting. It can be tough to find room for teams, because team statistics are a little bit harder than individual statistics. The one that I have here, other than what I've mentioned, is I apologize, because this is another Packer rival. In fact, a very proximate Packer rival. The 1989 San Francisco 49ers won 18 consecutive road games between 1988 and 1990. That's exactly 50% more than the second place New England Patriots, who won 12 straight road games in 2017. And also in the middle of that streak, the 49ers won the 1990 Super Bowl by the largest margin in history. So I discovered those statistics, which get into the 50% club, by trying to run down some stats about Jerry Rice, who did not himself make it into the club. But the team stats are sometimes a little bit harder to come by, because there's just a lot more stats that we attach to individuals.
Derek, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic. We talked to him about his new piece for the magazine. It's out today. It's called What's the Most Amazing Statistical Achievement in U.S. Sports History? Got some of the examples from the piece. You can find more online at theatlantic.com. Coming up after the news on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk to a cookbook author about letting go of perfectionism in the kitchen. I've done that. And using cooking as a means of self-care. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the filibuster made news again this week when Senate Republicans used it to scuttle a Democratic push for voting rights legislation. We'll talk about some of the history of the move, why it's been used so much more in recent decades, and ways it could change in the future. Now, cooking can be stressful. There's figuring out what to make, frantic last-minute trips to the grocery store, and, of course, at the end of a long day of work and family, you got to summon the energy to put the meal together. In a new cookbook, our next guest takes a closer look at the pressure surrounding something that we might take for granted, feeding ourselves. On this edition of Food Friday, she opens up about how that stress has played out in her own life and shares some strategies that have helped her find joy and self-care while she cooks. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you deal or have you dealt with stress and pressure around cooking? If so, when does that come up for you? Have you found a way to deal with that stress? Is cooking sometimes a calm and fun activity, sometimes a quick and stressful activity? What makes the difference? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Leanne Brown is a cookbook author. Her first book, Good and Cheap, about cooking on limited income, was downloaded over 15 million times after going viral. She's with us today to talk about her latest. It's called Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. Leanne, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, it's so good to be here.
Well, you cover territory, but you have recipes, of course, in your cookbook, but you cover a territory that a lot of cookbooks don't go into, our mental well-being. Why did you want to talk about that in relation to cooking?
Well, it really came up after my last book, Good and Cheap. I had the chance to talk to so many different people, and I kept having this experience over and over. Either someone would come up to me after an event, or someone would email me, or otherwise get in contact, and they'd often just tell me this story of, they'd say, oh, I love what you're doing, but you know, you can't help me, I'm a terrible cook. And then we'd have this conversation, and almost always what would come out of it was, I'd be like, well, why do you think you're a terrible cook? And they'd say, oh, well, you know, my kid doesn't like my food and they don't eat enough vegetables. Or sometimes the food I make just isn't very good. Or the one that really broke my heart a lot of the time was someone told me I was a bad cook one time. And so I just believe it. And it was just like, so I couldn't look away from this experience because I realized that I love to be able to bring some reality to that and say like, none of those things mean you're a bad cook. I have experienced every single one of these and I am a professional, you know, like this is just a normal part of cooking. And so it was often this really lovely connecting experience, but I also just saw a lot of myself in that, that I hold myself to these high standards and that there's something in sort of the culture, I think in our culture very much in general, but certainly it's in our food culture that there's so much perfectionism. There's so much worry about sort of what makes you a good, as though there can be a good or a bad cook, as though there are these standards and they're all about sort of performing for others. And I wanted to just bring more reality to that and recognize that home cooking is about cooking for ourselves in our messy lives. It is not about cooking in a studio. It is not about, you know, cooking in a restaurant. It's really what's best for us. And that's what our standards should be, and to bring it back to that.
And in your book, you talk about a challenging time for you. I think this is true for a lot of people. It's true for me with young kids either on the way or in the house. All of a sudden, time is a very different thing.
Completely. It absolutely changed me. And it, after my daughter was born, was this particularly challenging time, but it had kind of been difficult before that because while I was pregnant, I had gone through a kind of was an existential crisis for me as a cookbook author that I had been sick the whole time. I'd been nauseous the whole time. And so I just wasn't interested in food for like almost 9 months. And it was really, really challenging to figure out one, how to feed my body, which I needed to do, of course, because I was like growing a human being. I still needed that energy, but I was completely uninterested in food. And it made it really difficult, of course, to sort of do my job and do what normally brought me so much joy and made me feel creative, made me feel competent, made me kind of feel like me. And all of a sudden I didn't have that. And so then after, when I kind of got my appetite back, but all of a sudden I didn't have time, I just was like, I just really had to go through this experience of frankly, helping myself not identify so much with what I make and what I cook as though that's who I am. It's really, you know, I'm much more than that. That's just something that I do. And I wanted to kind of share that experience, and I think I really had to go through it myself in order to have something to offer to others.
Now, you talk about that mindset change of saying, you know, my food that I make isn't me and we don't have to be perfectionists. You also give a lot of practical advice. And one thing I love, and this is something actually we stumbled into as kids, meals that are assembly only. They're not actually really cooking, but you can still come out with a good meal. Can you give us some of the examples that you have in mind?
Totally. I have this whole section at the beginning of the book that's sort of like, yeah, we think of assembly only as like, make yourself a cheese board. It's like, get some nuts, get some cheese, get some crackers, get some little veggies, like anything goes. It can be a fun way to kind of scramble through the cupboards and think about combinations. It can be a really fun way to experience new flavors, I think. And sometimes without the sort of risk factor of like, making maybe a soup or something where you're trying a bunch of new combinations. Like you can just put two things in your mouth at the same time and see what that's like. It could be a really fun way to explore. And I think that's sort of another thing. There are so many people who would tell me like, oh, I didn't have a proper meal because I just like grabbed some stuff from the cupboard. And it's like, that's a proper meal. It works. It worked for you. It fed your body. It's great.
Yeah, I had that mindset, you know, it's like, I am going to cook for my family and my kids. And if I was just putting stuff on, like you say, a platter or a board, I'm cheating somehow.
Right.
Like, why?
What? Isn't that so funny? And we all do that. And it's like, where does that come from? Who says that? Like, why does it have to be hot? Why does it have to look a proper way? It's like, so long as it's satisfying you, it's meeting your needs. Oh my goodness. It's always good enough. I think I've loved hearing from people who've told me that that's helped them too. And my sister-in-law sent me this cute little picture the other day, and she had set out some minute rice and some leftovers on her counter. And she was like, I'm just gonna, you know, make a meal of these things. And a week ago, I would have felt really guilty, like I wasn't having a proper meal. And now I am enjoying it and noticing that it's actually really tasty and I'm feeling proud of myself. And like, I don't know, it's such a small thing, but I think anytime you can relieve a little bit of suffering or sort of unnecessary guilt and not only just relieve it, but actually almost turn it into a win. I feel like that just gives us energy, you know, in the rest of our lives, which is really the whole point of eating. It's actually to give us energy and to feel good about ourselves. And if we do that every time, then it, you know, gets us through. Whereas if every time we eat, it's like, I'm worried. There's 18,000 ways to fail. It's not going to do that for us, right?
Talking to Leanne Brown about her new cookbook. It's called Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that thing you make when you got 20 minutes to get a meal on the table for you and a family and a company or whatever? Or maybe just for you, do you have a go-to quick, simple meal that you enjoy? Is cooking stressful to you? Did you find ways to beat the stress of meal preparation? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Leanne, this is, of course, a cookbook and there are recipes. You've shared some with us. I want to check out a couple. Now, you got a crisp and I love crisp. We're on the same page here. It's easier than like pie. It's on that magical frontier between breakfast and dessert. You gave us a breakfast apple and orange crisp. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Oh, it's so funny also that you said it's easier than pie. It was so funny. My sister texted me the other day and she was like, I want something that's like a hot smoothie, but like not as hard as pie. So we thought of crisp. And so this, it's like a breakfast time crisp. And that might sound maybe like overly decadent, but it really, it's not overly sugared. It's really like an oatmeal meets, you know, fruit kind of situation. And I really love to actually make this the night before because I am super not a morning person. And so it gives me something to look forward to that I know I can just pull out of my fridge and warm it up and it's going to be wonderful. It's going to sort of be everything that I need it to be. It's going to be delicious. It's going to kind of wake up my senses. And it still has like all those lovely breakfast things. It's baked apples, but also I've made this with, you know, any kind of frozen fruit that I happen to have around for smoothies. Like my daughter and I have made a like blueberry, blackberry one before. You could use just about any fruit and it will come out really, really well.
And what stands out to this to me that I've never done, I've done everything you just said, except it's orange. You got orange zest in there. You squeeze in the orange juice.
Oh, yes.
That sounds great.
Oh my gosh. I love, I kind of use the orange as a sweetener here to just, cause I didn't do as much sugar as you might in a traditional sort of crisp for dessert. But when you add the orange juice, it will caramelize everything. And it has, of course, that lovely sort of bright zinginess that will blast through it, which I'm obsessed with. I never use a citrus in my house without also using the zest. And I strongly encourage everyone to do the same. It's good and savory. It's good and sweet. It's good everywhere.
We're going to call her at 800-642-1234. Teresa is with us in Fond du Lac. Teresa, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what'd you want to tell us about, Teresa?
Oh, well, I was just telling the lady that cooking is definitely an expression of love. Valentine's Day is right around the corner. You know, if you have a boring job, you have a way to be creative now in the kitchen. And when you make something from scratch, I think it's a great expression of love for yourself, what you're going to put in your body to nourish your body and your loved ones. So, and it's healthier and it's more economical. And stop comparing yourself to the Martha Stewarts because there's a lot of other people out there that I adore, like Pioneer Woman, Ree Drummond, and Ina Garten, and Jada. So there's not just one Martha. There's Rachel Ray. So stop comparing.
Teresa, thanks so much for sharing that. I'm glad you enjoy cooking. And Leanne, I know you've been in both places where cooking feels like work and cooking is an amazing creative outlet. How do we get our mindset into finding those opportunities for that more fun and free side of cooking?
Well, so I think part of it, the trick, at least for me, is truly accepting that sometimes you are just going to be stressed or you do only have 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so it's about kind of creating those ways that it can be a ritual to create more space in your life and also to just really accept where you're at. I think sometimes there can be months, even years, where you aren't going to be able to have as much space and time for cooking as maybe you would like. And rather than sort of fighting that and resisting that, you accept it and you simplify what you're doing. And that's an expression of love for yourself, not just sort of in the, oh my gosh, you know, I gotta like, you know, be running around at top speed for 20 minutes, like making the absolute best of this, but actually knowing maybe I simplify, maybe I just make a one bowl, you know, pasta dish or something, and I take my time with it. I take some deep breaths and trust that that's enough. And also that, especially if you're cooking for others in these sorts of situations, I think it's so important, like, you know, others in your household, like your family, to that when you come to the table after, you know, maybe a long day, and then you've really sort of overstretched yourself in the kitchen, and you're like, huh, you're like sweating and exhausted from what you've done and frustrated, you're kind of bringing that energy into that connection time, which often means that you're not going to be able to connect as well. I know I've done that a million times. Whereas if instead you sort of simplified, and then you allow yourself to come to the table, you know, having taken maybe some deep breaths and even released some of the tension from the day, you're actually going to get to connect. And that's going to feed you too, just as much as maybe a fancier meal or something more involved might have. So I think it's really about accepting wherever you are at and kind of adapting to that, like really thinking of yourself and your own standards before those of others.
Thanks for the call, Teresa. We're talking to Leanne Brown, author of the new book, Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has cooking been a source of stress or of stress relief at different points in your life, or maybe at different points in this last week? What emotions are tied to eating and cooking for you, for better or worse? Have you found things that help you de-stress in the kitchen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday conversation about the new cookbook, Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. Leanne Brown stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to simplify things in the kitchen? Have you changed your mindset, moving away from getting everything just right and just having fun, coming up with something good along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, we've got some recipes from Leanne up at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can cook them this weekend if you like. We heard about that breakfast apple and orange crisp. Leanne, you've got another one. This is a fast white bean chorizo and hearty greens stew. Now, it starts with fast and ends with stew, which I don't always think of as a combination.
Totally. I know what you mean. I guess I think of stew as like thicker than a soup, but still can be. This one really is quick, and it's part of the what does that is it used just a few ingredients, but they're all really, really packed with flavor. And this one always shocks me by just how delicious and flavorful it is. I'm always like, really? I don't need to add more of it. It's just some onion and bell pepper, and you could add more veggies if you like. And then sort of the key ingredient is I love fresh chorizo sausage, but you could absolutely use, you know, your favorite sausage of whatever kind if you like something less spicy or if you want sort of a different flavor. And that's such a great way to sort of add flavor to your dishes without having to add like six or seven other different things. Sausage is already full of lovely spices and flavor. And so that gets in there and some tomato paste, and then we're adding beans, and it all sort of comes together, and you finally get your greens in there, and you just have this magnificent sort of far-reaching bowl of super stew that just is amazingly satisfying and truly takes about 20 minutes. And they're not 20 minutes that you're running around. It's really just getting to sit there and gently and carefully do it. And again, I guess the process to me is so, so important. And I think that's so much of how you take cooking from something that feels stressful. I know I still come into it with them. I'm like, oh my gosh, everyone's hungry. I got to get it done. And what always helps me is just be like, okay, Leanne, just focus on where you are right now and just this one thing in front of you rather than worrying about the outcome. Because I think so often we're always judging ourselves by like, is it going to be so awesome? Or is everyone going to like it? And when we worry about that, it's like the mentality of like taking a test that you're being graded on. And it's really hard to just be in the now. And the fact is, it just doesn't matter. Like, not every home meal is going to be fabulous. Some of them are just going to be okay. And that's so normal. And like, we just don't need to be that stressed out that every meal, you know, the next one needs to be better or, you know, at least as good as that last one. It's just too much for us. We can just enjoy that we have something warm and that we've done our best and, you know, tick some of the boxes. And that really, really is good enough.
You can find that recipe again at WPR.org/Food Friday. Another piece of advice you share in the book, Leanne, is pre-preparing ingredients, whether that's having those boiled eggs on hand for that quick assembly, put it in your mouth meal, or having things ready to cook with. What kinds of things do you like to do when you do have that time to get ready for when you don't have that time?
Oh, I mean, I always think of that as like, it's a gift to my future self. And so I love having like treats in the freezer, like, you know, maybe pre-made cookie dough sort of for treats and making a larger quantity of things that keep really well in the freezer. Like actually a stew is a great example. Stews and chilies, they're classic sort of examples of something that if you keep it in the fridge or the freezer, they actually get better over time. I mean, within reason, there's a limit to that, but the flavors will actually enhance over time. And so that's a wonderful thing to do, as well as frankly, if you really are going for it and you're feeling like I've got 20 minutes, I'm going to do something so great for myself. Pre-chopping fruits and vegetables is such a lovely thing to do for yourself. I know so many of us are always trying to eat more fruits and vegetables. They of course help our body in so many ways, but they often come like you got to do a few things to them before you can just pop them in your mouth. Whereas like the crackers are ready to go. So when you pre-chop them, you can actually just grab them out of the fridge when hunger strikes. And that feels so honestly luxurious to me, I find. I also love putting just like wedges of lime or something in water. That's another thing that just feels, it's such a simple thing to do, but it makes you feel like you're, you know, at a special spa or something.
Talking to Leanne Brown about her new cookbook, Good Enough. There's one more recipe you shared with us that I definitely want to get to because it's real cold here in Wisconsin today, Leanne. You've got a cozy cold weather bouillon. I never know how to pronounce this one. Bouillonese. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can pronounce it better than I can. Tell us about it and why it's great for a cold day.
So this one, I mean, it's just so classic. I really crave like a meaty, rich, tomato-y, fabulous kind of pasta dish when it's cold out. And it's this one does take more time. It's something to sort of spend an afternoon on and really get into the experience. I like making this on the weekend when I have a little bit more time because the smells just make everyone happy. I mean, we live in an apartment building and I know that our neighbors are always like, oh, what are you making? It's just such a, that's the thing about cooking. And maybe again, just that little reminder that you're actually so lucky every time we cook, we get so much out of the process, you know, all those aromas. It's like, you get to experience that when you make that, you get to enjoy the feeling and the beautiful sounds of like chopping or water boiling, or even that feeling of like, I cut lemon and it squirted out and I smelled it, but then a little bit got on my cuticles and it kind of stings. And it's just like all so visceral and real and sensual in a way. And I think that there's something so meaningful about that, but that we miss when we focus so much on the flavor and the outcome.
Just in our last few moments, Leanne, you also talk about the idea of practicing gratitude with our food. Could you spend just a minute or so telling us about that?
Yeah, this has been a real big one for me. I think I've always felt that gratitude is hugely important, but I didn't have the best relationship with it. I think I always thought, oh, you should be grateful was sort of my mentality. And if I wasn't feeling it, I'd feel really guilty about that. But so something I share in the book, this little gratitude practice, and it's something I try to do whenever I can with food in particular, is I just sit down and think about all of the people who were involved in getting this meal to me. You know, obviously like there's maybe me because I made it, but there's also all the people at the grocery store, my husband and I, who both, you know, make the money in the house to buy the things, the farmers and the people who put it on ships, and like all of the ways in which this food gets into this bowl. It's actually incredible. And I think there's something, so I often, even talking about it, I kind of get chills. Like I get really touched thinking about the community nature of food and how connected it really is. And that gets me sort of into a true place of gratitude and a true place where I don't feel alone, which I think has been so, so important, especially over the last couple of years where so many of us have felt really isolated. And, you know, we know that we are part of a community and we're all experiencing things together, but it's hard to really feel.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to our guest, Leanne Brown. Her new book is Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. If you're like me, you like breakfast cereal, and you may be on the lookout for some variety. Well, help is on the way from the world of artificial intelligence research. Janelle Shane of the website AI Weirdness, past guest on this show, trained some neural networks on marketing material for new breakfast cereals and then had them make up some of their own. A couple normal-sounding ones, Cinnamon Toast Crunch with Marshmallow Cream, features the classic taste of Cinnamon Toast with a marshmallow cream center, and Rice Krispie Treats Hazelnut Fudge. Exquisite hazelnut fudge gooey clusters made with 0% white cane sugar. Then things get weird. Non-stick carbonated waffle balls. Gold standard for fun waffle ball innovation using wheat-based flavors and crispy aluminum foil. And don't forget original Cool Ranch cheese and dried cranberry oatmeal. All the wholesome cheesy oatmeal with a choice of mild, sweet, or salty. Find more at AIweirdness.com. The most important meal of the day. This is Central Time.